teacher. The book is simple, it's written as an introduction, very clear. It's called The Age Fields. Knots and physics. And I do recommend it pretty strongly. Now, if you want really something real math, and you want sort of the reference for all these things, the universally recognized reference is the Kobayashi Yomitsu. The book is called proper title, Foundations of Differential Geometry. And it's a very good book, which has a reputation of being tough, hard. It's just a mathematical style, so theorem, definition, theorems. And it's famous because you open the first page, and the first page there's a definition of what is a manifold, that just a definition takes a page and a half. And when you're a student and you open it, you say, well, no. But there's everything about Mandel's, about geometry, about Riemannian geometry, about it's very good. There are two volumes. And you can find it easily. Now, if you want something, other books. If you want something very specific, on because it might not be in any of these, nor the other that I mentioned later. Something very specific. For instance, there is this Holst term, like. So if you want to view it in the context of the corresponding topological environment in the geometry distortions and and everything, and there are some lectures by Zanelli, which I find precise. You can find them online. The title is Torsional Topological Environments. So that's not a general production of differential geometry, and but you find that Mills, Young, topological environment, things which are strictly related to this, to the global properties of the bundles that are defined by the connection that I wrote and the action.
What is his first name?
Jorge Zanelli.
That is
Jorge.
Cheese.
J-O-R-G-E.
Yeah,
George
okay.
In Spanish.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Then I put three books in, so they all differ quite different, four, five, six, but the three books in sort of basic differential geometry where you find all that, because I think they're good reference, you may use it. The one I like since ever, to math or physics is analysis is a so-called three girls, three women, is Yvonne Cécile David. Cécile is a very good mathematician. Swarp on path integrals, Swarp, and was the wife of Bryce David, who was the one who will do the question. And the third is Margaret D. Lard Blake. And the book is called Analysis in Electrical Physics. And then there is the Nakahara, and it's a, I should write better, sorry for writing so bad. Which is called Geometry, Topology, physics and Frankel, if you don't know it. Let me say something about these three. Frankel, F-R-A-N-K-E-L, the geometry physics. These are all introductions to the fracture geometry written. Think of physics. This is a lot of pictures. Sort of try to be visual. But it's slightly less clean and clear than the other. This is very simple, I find it very clean. That's my preferred one since, because I've used it since ever. So it's written from people who also do physics and have a sense of what's useful. There's a lot of, in it, a lot of mathematical physics. And in all these books you should find the proper definitions, connections, bundles. Okay? I recommend first. Good. So, where are we? We did the Hilbert space and operators, so all the kinematics of quantum gravity in three dimensions. Right? Hilbert spaces. So now you know how to, if you have a state, you know how to compute geometry. You just use standard quantum mechanical rules, and you know the geometry of three-dimensional. But this is not the theory, of course, because the theory is transition amplitude. So this lecture is about transition amplitude. And I'm going to write explicitly a possible definition of transition amplitude for three-dimensional gravity in 3D, and this will complete the theory. So it's lecture 8. Finally, transition amplitude. And again, the aim is not to do a mathematical derivation of transition amplitude from classical theory. The idea is to use the classical theory as a hint, as a suggestion for building up some transition amplitude. So what we want is transition amplitude. So we want objects which, as I said at the beginning, depend on some discretization, alpha Feynman, because you write it, and that is the discretization will be some triangulation, and depend on states on the boundary, on configurations on the boundary. Okay, in fact, as Feynman defined it, right, the transition amplitude by a path integral, you need an initial state and a final state. So they're going to depend on one of the states that I just wrote down, and another state that I just got around. So this is Euclidean. Past future doesn't make many sense, so you can in fact close the thing, take just a finite piece of space-time, the boundary, and just put a state on the boundary without distinguishing past and side and future. So the idea is that you have some piece of space-time, we have some boundary, which you can, for simplicity, think there is a past and a future with some surface sigma. There's some state here, so you take the tensor of this, the two, and the easiest thing is to use the spin network basis that I just wrote down. So this is going to be a function of some spins in some graph sitting here with some spins and some graph sitting there. So J and J prime. Okay. Why there is no time? Well, I gave you a full explanation, full lecture of showing that you don't need time for that. Time is hidden among some of the variables there, because that's generativity. This time is hidden among the component of the metric tensor. So if we have that, we have essentially a definition of the theory order by order by some approximation, which is given by this triangulation here. So for every possible state, which is given by a graph and some j, you can write transition amplitudes in between. So that's the object I want to define. Now, to define it, and roughly, very roughly, this is going to be the integral of the geometry inside, geometry in bulk, of the action of this geometry with, well, the boundary of the geometry is a boundary state. That's what we are trying to define. Very roughly. So we were a precise version of this, sort of hand-waving thing. Now let me start for simplicity, because then it will be very easy to write them down. Instead of writing that, take a three-dimensional space without boundaries and write out the partition function of the thing, which is this when there is no boundary. Okay? Then once you have an expression for that, it will be easy to correct it to put boundary. So let me just start by defining the object, which is this, when this M here has no boundary. This is a three sphere, for instance. If you take a three sphere, you triangulate it, okay, and then you want to define the functional integral of the geometries. E to the I S of the geometry. Okay? Something like that. So all these are motivational. These are not strict mathematical equalities. It's to motivate the definition which is going to come. So what we want something like the functional integral in the triad, the functional integral in the connection, because these are the fields we are considering, leaning on some fixed manifold with some fixed topology with no boundary. And the exponent of I and the I over h bar, in fact, to be precise, I h bar g, which I write it once and then I put it equal to 1 and forget about it. The three-dimensional integral of E wedge f of omega. Okay? This is the object we want to... Well, we're not very far already. Because, look, this is an integral in E of the exponent of I E something. Okay? Which immediately tell us that if we have any vaguely decent definition of this functional integral, it better has that, you know, what is the integral in dx? E to the IPX. What is it? Delta of P. Up to some 2 pi, which goes somewhere, I don't remember, probably here, is delta of P. Right? So, if there's any decent definition of if E, this is better to be equal the integral of d omega of course, there's some normalization factors, right? Because this measure have to define them. So let's absorb everything we don't care in the normalization factor. After all, we only later on need ratios of this thing to compute observables. Sort of the product in all space-time, the product in all space-time points of delta of omega, of f of omega. So it's going to be the integral on all SL2C, sorry, on all SU2 connections on this compact three-dimensional space, which are flat. Okay. And of course, I mean, all this is still, this is an infinite dimensional space. But this is not so badly defined now, because, of course, to define this, you have to divide by the gauge. The connection transform under SU2 gauge transformation. So whatever the definition of this, the well-defined definition of this has to do up to gauge transformations. So this, in fact, should be the integral of flat connections modulo gauges. The space of flat connection modulo gauges is a finite dimensional space. Okay, so we're already doing better. So it makes sense. Now that we're doing this, well, let's remember that we're working on a discretization, and what we really want to do is not to define this on all continuous fields, but the discretized version of this. So in fact, we want to integrate over our discretized E and discretized omega this thing here. So what we really want to do, okay, all these are is the integral in dE, remember, E was on the bonds, which are the faces, and dU, these are the edges of e to the I sum over the faces of the trace of e f uf, where uf, remember, so let's remember the geometry here. We have in the bulk tetrahedra, and we're looking at the dual. So this is e, this is v. So for each vertex, v, you have four edges, and for each edge, E, you have three faces. Okay? There's one vertex here, an edge, and three faces around. One vertex here, one edge, and three faces to all to these things around. So the E sits on this line, which is to say the faces, and the U sits on the edges, which are here, and each one of these faces go around one of the edges. So given a face, there is a sequence of edges that go around it. And UF is just the product of the group elements around the face, which can be as many as you want. Because in a triangulation, you put tetrahedra around and given a bond, there can be many. Many tetrahedra around it. So this is indeed what we want. Okay, now we're getting closer to it. But now you see immediately I can play the same game. And in fact, this can be done, this passage can be done precisely. It takes a little bit of working out exactly the trace here, what it means, but it gives exactly the same thing as before. Or if you want, you can start from here and just take the discrete version of here. And define this as the integral on all the U's, so the discretized connections on the edges, of the product on what? There's one integral for each one of these on the faces. Okay, so this is a discrete version of the product on all the points of delta of UF, where UF is a product of UE. So UF is a function of this, and there are many of these. Okay, and the way the UEs sit inside the UF is dictated by the triangulation. So all this depends on the triangulation. So this, I should put the triangulation here. Now this is perfectly well defined now. Well, I mean, it's much better defined now. It might diverge, but up to the fact that it's a divergent integral, it's perfectly well defined. Okay? And this is a crucial formula. So this is the object. In a sense, we have found it. We just have to write it better. But this is the transition amplitude. Now, if I write, I could put state in the sort of momentum basis J, or could put state in the coordinate basis U here. Okay. In that case, I will have an open triangulation. There will be some U's sitting here. So when I integrate, some of the faces could go through the boundary. So in that case, I will only be integrated on the bulk edges, while the boundary edges would remain out, and we get something which depends on the boundary. So I can define the transition amplitude. But let's look at this. Let's look at this and let's work on this. Let's actually write it in the spin network basis, because that's where one starts seeing what this thing is and how to use this. So let's give a better sense of that. Of that object. Let's try to write it better. First thing we want to do is to expand the delta functions in the momentum basis, if you want. Okay. Now there is a formula which you find in this is again mathematics in the books on SU2 representation theory, which is the following. This can be written as a sum of all the spins from j from 0 to infinity of the dj, so 2j plus 1, times the trace of the matrix element du in the representation j. Now, this formula you find in books, but if you think for a moment, you could have easily guessed this formula, because again, remember the analogy with U1. Okay? This formula is so delta of alpha, that's, remember, U1, the elements are angles, can be written as a sum over the representations, representation n. Trace is dj is all one dimensional, so all the dimensional representation is one. The trace is not there because the dimensional representation is one dimensional. And this is ipn alpha, which is correct, right? If you put the right measure here, it's 2 pi. Remember, 2 pi goes up and down. So the expansion of a delta in representations is. It's true for all compact groups. In fact, it can be written, this is a general theorem. This is the one for U1. This is the one for SU2. In fact, it's true for all groups, for all compact groups. It's just harmonic analysis on a compact space. The delta function, you expand it in modes, and that's what it gets.
Is there a good argument why it has to be the trace and not a determinant? Just from... Is there something obvious to...
Yes, because it is a trace, it is a class function. It does not depend on... it is invariant if you multiply u by v minus 1. It's gauge invariant. So, for instance, if it is a... think about u as a rotation element.
Yeah.
It has to be a function that just depends on the angle of the rotation and not the direction.
Okay.
And all those functions just depend on the trace. Okay. And the trace of the element is just the cosinus of the angle. Something that knows about how far you are from the origin in the group, but not in which direction you're going out from the group.
Okay.
It's a class. Okay. So let's use it there. So Z. Given triangulation is given the integral of dUe, one per each edge, and the product on all the faces of the sum in J of dJ trace of dJ of U. Now, the product of the sum is a sum of products. Okay? A plus B plus C times E plus is AE plus. So let's do it. So this is a sum in J, but careful, there's one label J for each F. So we better call it JF, just not to get confused when we have many of them. So let's put an F inside here. So there's each face has its own expansion in spins. So it's an expansion in spin, one per each face. And then there's integral. No, and then there's all these DJs. That we just bring them together. So it's going to be the product on all the faces of DJ, F, all these factors here. And then what remains? It remains the integral in all the DU, L, of these traces. So the product on all the faces of the trace, and let me just write the U here, UE1, UEN, where these are the ones of that particular face I'm considering. So these are SU2 integrals, each one of these, the Hall measure, of just a bunch of U element of there, and this is, of course, the trace in the representation. So this, I should write... Let me put a J here. UJ, what I really mean is DJ of U. Okay. These are in the representation. Of course, the A representation of a product is a product of representation, but this is a representation.
What are the indices on the E? As U, J, E, E.
E1, E, so let's go slowly. UF, okay? That's what it is. So now, of course, DUV is DUDV, okay? So, and UF, it's a product of things, the product of stuff. So I can write this as DU, all in the representation J, and these are what? There is an F here, these are all JF, and these are the sequence of E's, which are in the face, around the face F, 1 to N. And I just, if you want, you can put an F to remember. Just, I don't want to make notation over heavy. These are the edges around the face F. Now, let's look at these integrals. We have one integral per each edge. Of course, each edge lives in many faces. So this integral, one single integral here, sees a certain number of these faces. How many? Well, one edge sits exactly in three faces because it's dual to a triangle which has three sides around. So each one of these integrals has the form du of that particular edge, and then there is u of that particular edge, there are three of them, sitting in different representations, J1, DJ2, and DJ3, because it comes from three different faces around, each one with its own representations, with all the indices which glue it to whatever is around in the traces. So let me write the indices here, M1, N1, M2, N2, M3, N3, that are going to be attached to the traces of whatever else. So all the integrals have exactly this structure. But this integral, we know how to do it. Why? Well, because this is a simple integral on SU2. Okay, and what could it be? It is something that depends on J1, J2, J3. Okay, but this is a Hahn measure. It's invariant if I multiply it on the left or on the right. So let's multiply it on the left by V. This is the same as putting a V here, a V here, and a V here. Okay, and it should remain the same. But if I put a V here, it's like multiplying by a SU2 group elements on the indices M1, M2, and M3. So this is something with three indices, M1, M2, and M3, such that when I act on it with a transformation, SU2 transformation, remain itself. And we said there's only one such element, which is M1, M2, M3, J1, J2, J3. The Wigner matrix can only be that up to a number. But the same is true if I act on the right. So also with respect to the three indices, N1, N2, N3, J1, J2, J3, should be the Wigner up to a number. Okay, but in fact, I've never fixed the number in the usual standard mathematical normalization of the Wigner 3 symbols. And the usual standard mathematical normalization of the Wigner 3 symbols is the one that is the one here. So that normalizes these things up to a phase. Forget this. So a little bit more clean, simple notation. These are just two intertwiners, I and 1 and 2. So for each edge, let me redo that picture there, which has three faces. And to each face, we have assigned a spin here, J. J1, J2, J3. When I do this integral, okay, I produce two of these intertwiners. Let me write them here, I, M1, M2, M3. And here I, N1, N2, N3. Why? Because each one of these traces go around the face. and multiply the element I've integrated with respect to the next one around the face, so this way, and the first one around the face, so this way. So for the one element, for instance, the M1 and N1 are respectively attached to something which is here, to something which is there. So better put them there. So now I do this integral, and I have just a bunch. Z delta is going to be a sum of a JF, product on F DJF, and then what? Just the product, a long product of I. Right? Because I do all the integrals and I do all the just I's, so just intertwiners, with all their indices. Each one has three indices. A lot of them. Now, all these indices are attached to one another because they came from traces where they were attached to one another. And how are they attached to one another? Well, let's look what happens here. Here there was a vertex with that face, that edge, okay? But then there were three others, this one, and this one. And the index here is attached to the one coming from this other vertex here. This one is attached to this, this one is attached to this, this one is attached to this. So they're attached according to the faces of the dual tetrahedron, of the original tetrahedron we start from, right? And so the four eyes that come, that sit here, 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 and here, are attached to themselves. So it all comes all this I comes in groups, which are four. And there's one of these groups per each tetrahedron, where the indices are A, B, B, C, C, D, D, E, E, F, F, appropriately glued together in the correct representation of SL to C, of SU2 in which they live. So in other words, there's one eye here, one eye here, one eye here, one eye here. There's one index A that joins this, one index B that joins this, one index C that joins this, one index that joins this, one index that joins this. Okay? Summed over all these things. And of course, this depends on the six representations, JA, JB, etc., that sits around the vertex, because around the vertex there are six faces. Remember the picture? No? Remember this face here, this face here, this face here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Each one has a spin, so each face has a spin, each edge has an intertwiner, and I have four intertwiners meeting, and there are six spins, and one per each couple of edges. Now, this object has a name, so this is summed over the indices A, B, C, D, E, F. This object has a name, because it's something that depends on six representations, and it's called a six-jsim, Wigner six-jsim. Wigner, six-jsim. It's something that in atomic theory, molecular theory, nuclear theory is used heavily. There are books in which the table are written down. If you use Mathematica and you just type 6J symbol and you put three numbers, it splits a number, which is the number of that. You have a question?
Yeah, the indices in that expression seems to be...
not matching?
Or there seems to be four at the first intertwiner, and then three at the next one, and then three at the last.
Oh, maybe. Let me do. I went very fast. Sorry. Maybe I didn't do it properly. So, A, this and this. This and this is B, B. And this is this and C and C. And I'm done with this three. Then here I have this and this D, D, and E, E, and finally F, F. So 3, 3, 3, 3. And for the 12 indices double, so it's 6. So I probably just wrote. So let me just do properly which is which, because the 6-day symbol is written. Let me try to remember the proper way of writing it. If I write here J1, J2, J3, so clockwise going out, then the 6-day symbol is usually written this way. So J1, J2, J3. So this is a triangle. The upper line is a triangle. And then opposite of J1 is J4, right here. And opposite to J2, there's J5, back one. And opposite to J3 is J6, right it here. This is just the convention for writing the J's when you find it in the Mathematica. It's written in this way. The books is written this way. So the upper line is a triangle. The bottom line is not a triangle, it's a vertex with the opposite things. And J1 and J4 are opposite. J1 and J4. Given a tetrahedron, you have always two opposite. Okay, and J1, J2, and 3 are the cyclic order is going out. This has a lot of symmetries, of course, all the symmetries of the tetrahedron. For instance, if you take this line and you put it on the back, it's the same number, and so on. These are studied, are tabled, are sort of all sort of wonderful properties and they're used a lot every time there's AC2 symmetry. Okay, so it's a single number that depend on just 6 representations. All right, so yeah, yeah. So the result of all that is that the partition function on a given triangulation is given by the sum over spins associated to the faces, the product on the face of the dimension, so 2j plus 1 of that face, and then the product on the vertex of the 6-day symmetry. This is the partition function of three-dimensional quantum gravity in this particular representation. And the transition amplitudes are exactly the same object, of course, where, however, now the two-complex dual to the triangulation has boundaries. So on the boundary here, you have a graph. On the graph, you have some spin, which are the spins on the boundary. So in this sum here, you only sum on the internal things and not the thing in the internal faces and not the faces that end on the boundary. The faces that end on the boundary you keep fixed, and they stay out, and they are just functions of the of and they're just the independent variables of the transition function. Now, you say, well, so what? We have to find this transition amplitudes. Before I comment, and this is the main formula I wanted to get. Do you have questions? Have you understood how it came out? How it's defined? Is that clear enough? Now, this formula was found in the 60s by Tullio Regge and a young collaborator of him, a mathematician, which is called Ponzano. So it's called the Ponzano-Regge model for Euclidean 3D gravity, quantum gravity. That was long ago. I was not around, but people who were around at that time, he was in Princeton. Reggie was in Princeton at that time. It was John Wheeler. And there was a moment of enormous excitement because somehow there was a sort of quantum gravity coming out. It was beautiful. It was combinatorial. It was just, there was a great, great excitement about that. Where was excitement? Well, the excitement is basically in the fact that if you go back, it works, in the sense that Ponsano and Reggio proved a theorem. Well, in fact, they didn't prove a theorem. They argued for a theorem being correct and gave physicists kind of proofs. The actual theorem was proven by Roberts in 98, so much, much later, on the behavior of this 6J symbol. The 6J symbol, it was proven by them and then precisely by Roberts. When the spin is large, remember the spin is a quantum number of the area. So large quantum numbers, if you just take Bohr, vision of quantum mechanics, large quantum numbers means that you're in a semi-classical regime. So you start seeing quantum theory when you go down to small spins. Okay, when you go to Planck scale. As long as you're away from the Planck scale, you are in the classical theory. So the what these people showed that for large spin, so for large J, this is essentially the exponential e to the I the action of general relativity. And more precisely, it is some factor which happens to be 1 over 12, if I remember, pi, the volume of this tetrahedron, the volume of this tetrahedron in which sense? If you interpret spins as length, you can compute the volume of this tetrahedron. And then e to the I, the action of this tetrahedron, I'll say exactly what I mean in a moment, tetrahedron. In fact, not really that was puzzling at the time, plus e to the minus I reaction. And plus another puzzling factor, which is pi fourth. So I'll say in which sense there's an action there. But look what has happened. Reggio found a way of discretizing general relativity, which is not exactly what I gave, but very similar. In the discretized theory, wrote before that, is called Reggio calculus, and is a discretization of GR on a triangulation. Okay? And then sort of thought, well, maybe I can do a functional integral in that, and guessed out of blue sky, no reason whatsoever, that the length of the bone be quantized in multiples of 1/2. Okay? Just out of nothing. Say, let's imagine that for some mysterious reason, it was the 60, nobody had talked about that quantization of geometry at all. Let's imagine that the lengths are quantized of the original triangulation. Okay? So then the integral, the functional integral on geometry becomes a multiple integral on the length, but if they're quantized, it becomes a sum over discrete length. Okay? And let me imagine it's 1/2. Why? Well, he didn't know. Okay, just guessed. And let me write the sim, and so if they're the 1/2, they are representations of SU2. Because after all, it's a representation. So if I put here just the length of each sort of measure factor, which is the dimension of the representation, then to each vertex, I have 6 representations. And if I have 6 representations and I ask any mathematicians, how do I get a number out of 6 spins, he will say, oh, there's the 6J symbols of Wigner. Okay, just take the 6J symbol, stick them there, and then magic, I can prove that in the large spin limits, this 6J symbol is nothing else than the action of the tetrahedron. Well, what is the action of the tetrahedron? Well, it's just the Hamilton function of general relativity of a tetrahedron in three dimensions. So in other words, you take a tetrahedron, you look for the classical solution, which is flatness, of course, and you write properly the Hamilton function, and it's that thing there. Okay? So at the time, it was a complete surprise that one could this ansatz, so the Ponsano-Regge ansatz, is that the length is equal one half an integer number. In fact, what they had is plus one half to make this work precisely. This formula is exact if you interpret the length to be not j, but j plus one half, which in the large j limit gives the correct scaling of this thing. Now, why is these two terms here? Well, it's immediate, because the theory we're doing is not exactly general relativity. The theory we're doing, also in four dimensions, exactly the same thing, is E wedge F. Well, general relativity is square root of G R. Okay? Now, suppose I write this in terms of tetrad. So this is the Einstein-Hilbert action. If I write this in terms of tetrad, this is R of the tetrad, of course. And this is the square root of the determinant of G, which is the modulus of the determinant of E. If you write this in tensor notation, what you find, this is the determinant of E times R of E. So the two are different. You see, this is the tetrad. Here you have the determinant of E. Here you have the modulus of the determinant of E. So this, the Einstein-Hilbert action distinguishes between a triad and a triad with a minus. The Einstein-Hilbert action does not distinguish between a triad and a triad oriented the other way around. This does. So when you integrate on all the triads, you get, for each geometry, you get once the action with a sign and once the action with the opposite sign. So when you sum over all possible geometries, you get these two terms. Okay. So that's completely clear. The pi 4 also is clear, but I don't want to go into that. And after all, it's not there in the Lorentzian theory what we'll do. So tomorrow we'll give you some more details about the Regge calculus and exactly the definition of that action that I wrote down, but I don't want to overcharge today. I want to add one other piece of information. If the triangulation is sufficiently simple, this is a number. But if the triangulation is complicated, this diverges. And the reason how it can diverge, so divergences. Let me show you where the divergences come from. And this is crucial, because this is also going to be the possible divergences in four dimensions. This thing here are zero unless the J1, J2, J3 satisfy the triangular inequalities. Right? In other words, the edges sitting here are zero unless the three spins here are related by the triangular inequalities. Or in other words, the length of the triangle is zero, the amplitude of the triangle is zero unless the length satisfies the triangular inequalities, which is fine geometrically. So suppose there is some boundary, some j, okay? Suppose you have a triangulation with a boundary just one face. The single face, you have to sum over the spin of the single face. But it cannot be very high, cannot go very high, because at some point the triangular inequalities block it. Okay, once you have two spins which are fixed, the third one by the triangular inequality gets a maximum and dies. How can you free? Suppose you want to make this face arbitrarily large. Okay, then you have somehow with the triangular inequalities, there should be another next face next to it that go arbitrarily large. So you should have a sequence of faces such that they can all be arbitrarily large around when you go around at least one of the edges around it. Okay. So suppose this is a boundary, this is a boundary, this is a boundary. So this can be very large, this can be very large, but this is blocked by that. Unless this closes. Suppose there's another face here, another face here. And now suppose there are now six faces that form a bubble. Then you can make these arbitrarily large, and it's fine, because the triangular inequalities are good, because on all edges there's one small and two large. One small and two large is okay. So divergences come from bubbles. What is a bubble? It's a sequence of faces with a topology of S2. If you want to be very fancy and do the actual analysis of all possible divergences, this is the second Betti number of the triangulation. You can do more precise things. In fact, there are recent nice papers in which this is analyzed in detail. So if you have a bubble inside the triangulation, in the bulk, this sum here, the spins can go arbitrarily large. It's exactly what happens in Feynman diagrams where you have a loop, right? So in standard quantum field theory, you have loops that might diverge. Here, you have bubbles that might diverge. Okay? So the bubbles are analog of loops, Feynman loops, not the loops of loop quantum gravity. Right? This might diverge. So this can go arbitrarily high. Now, in the 90s, two mathematicians took that and were very interested in that. We're very interested in that because this is almost independent from the triangulation. So that's, for them, was interesting because it gives some number associated to a manifold, so it would be something to classify the topology of manifolds. But this is not really independent from the triangulation because plus diverges. So two mathematicians called Turaev and Viro asked, can we do this in a way which a mathematician would be happy and there are no divergences? And found an easy fix of it, which I'm not going to go into any detail. I just mentioned that it exists, which is go from replace SU2 with SU2Q. SU2Q is a quantum group. There's some nice mathematics attached to it. It's not a group. It's a deformation of the free algebra associated to the group. What is important about that is that it's an object that behaves very much like a group with a plus a parameter, where you can define a quantum deformed dq of j, which is a deformation of the dimension. Which converges to the standard dimension when SU2 converges to SU2. And you can define 6JQ. Deform the Wigner 6J symbols. So these are defined, and these are known in the literature. So you can define something which is Z on a given triangulation, which is just the sum over JF of the product on the faces of the Q of JF and then the products on the vertices of 6JQ. Okay? Now, if you choose Q appropriately, such that Q to the n for an arbitrary n is 1, so these are the roots of unity, Q, then the representations of this quantum group are just bounded from some 0, some j max. In other words, the 6j symbol go to 0, and this go to 0 disappear when j is larger than j max. It follows that with this choice of Q, which is pretty arbitrary because you can choose n as you want, with as large as you want, this is finite. Because it's a sum over finite things or finite things, everything is well defined. Okay? Say, well, okay, but you've done a very complicated trickery here. No, because now if you redo the asymptotic expansion of the J, you discover that the 6J Q is the exponent of the action of GR plus cosmological constant, where Q is e to the I lambda h bar g squared, I think, in two dimensions. So in other words, if you take the Q deformed version of that, you have an extra parameter. You get exactly the same asymptotic limit. You get the asymptotic and semi-classical limit generativity plus a cosmological constant. And the theory is finite.
And can you set the cosmological constant to 0? Or would you then recover?
Formally, you recover that. Because. That's right. On the transition functions themselves, it's a good question. People are looking into that. And in fact, the question is that, do the transition function of this in the limit Q going to 1 go to the transition function of that? And I haven't not got an answer from the people working on that. They don't know. The limit is a bad limit. It's a tricky limit. So, I don't know. The way I like to think about that is that in our universe, there is a cosmological constant. So we don't want a theory. Let me separate the answer in two parts. First, we do not want a theory where the cosmological constant is 0. We want a quantum theory of gravity where the cosmological constant is finite. Okay. So if we were in 3 dimensions, it is. We arrived. We have a theory where it's a description of quantum geometry. It's finite. All the transition amplitudes are finite. And we can compute okay. things.
But we can't predict the cosmological constant.
We can predict the cosmological constant in the same sense in which we can predict the electric charge, the Newton constant, the mass of the electrons. There are a lot of constants in physics. And they are equally unpredictable for us. So it's not the cosmological constant is more mysterious than the other. It's just, can we predict the Newton constant? No. Can we predict can we predict the charge of the electron? No, charge of the electron. So I don't see no reason why the problem of predicting the cosmological constant is of any more interest than predicting the. Of course, the mindset of people is different because since the electron constant is new since the middle 19th century, the end of the 19th century. People got used to that. Well, in nature there is a number; we have to deal with this number. While the cosmological constant was measured 5 years ago, so everybody's there saying, "Oh, we should understand it. We should understand where it comes from." But sure, we should. But we should first understand where the electron charge comes from. It's not more mysterious than the other. It's just maybe somebody could have a theory that predicts the value of these numbers. for the moment doesn't exist at all. And to me, the effort of trying to find a theory to predict the value of the cosmological constant is a little bit misplaced scientifically. If somebody has an answer, great. Here is no prediction at all. So here, a theory like that depend on, I'm going to be precise, it depends on two dimensional parameter, the Planck scale and the cosmological constant. It sits on, so it has a scale, the Planck scale. So you can do it, you can use the Planck units as your units, and then you write the theory in a completely dimensionless way. Okay, there are no dimensions in this expression here. Well, why could you write the theory in a dimensionless way? Well, because you're using units, Planck units. And then the theory is determined by one dimensionless constant, which is Q. Okay? Which, of course, if you, this is an exponent, the physical Q, if you believe that this is a discrete from the world, it's very, very close to one, right? Because the cosmological constant is very small in these units here. Okay, so it's the ratio of the cosmological constant to the Planck constant is 120. Okay, so there is 120 sticking around this theory, which is what? Which is the number of possible representations in the theory, the number of representations that are allowed in the theory. So it's a parameter in the theory. Oh, other questions? Yes.
Does the value of cosmological constant have to be just non-zero? Could it be positive or negative? Or
it can only be positive. The good one. It doesn't make sense with a negative one here. Which, let me give you the physics. Positive cosmological constants means closed space, right? It's and the closed space is the is essentially the size of this space here. And why the theory is finite? It's finite because you don't have arbitrary large things, because the cosmological constant sets a maximum scale, okay? And when you go into the small, you don't have arbitrary small things, right? You cannot go smaller than the Planck length, because your variable is a connection, which is you think there is a group, and the group is compact. So when you go small, essentially you're going to high momenta, but the high momenta on a compact group, where it's discrete. So it's a compact, the finite dimensional physical space that give the infrared physical cutoff, and the compactness of SU2, which gives the ultraviolet physical cutoff in the theory. Of course, you could do all that because this is not really a field theory, right? There's no space. There's no field function of space. So all this is undoable in a proper field theory, where you define the theory as a renormalization group, scaling, and so on and so forth. You have no field operators on a point here. So it's really something profoundly different.
Can you say anything about the continuum limit of this? Because this is an approximation by discretizing things, right? And we really should care about the continuum limit of this theory.
Yeah, in the three-dimensional case, which is the easy, I'm doing all that in three Euclidean dimensions because it's all nice and proper and perfect, okay? I forgot to tell the most important result at all of 2i0. This is independent of delta. It does not depend on the... You have to... Yeah, it is. Well, the theory is topological, only global degrees of freedom. So it doesn't have local degrees of freedom. In 4D, you will ask again your question, and it will be much more subtle and complicated and detailed. So that's why I said... In 3D, this triangulation is you discretize this functional integral, but in fact, this functional integral is a finite dimensional integral which is perfectly well defined. It's just the integral of flat connections up to gauges. So it's something, everything is nice and clean. This truncation is not really a truncation in 4D. For even given boundary state, you need a triangulation rich enough to be bounded by that. But then if you further refine the triangulation, the partition, the transition amplitudes just don't change. They have exactly the same value. So you're home. This is a complete, proper, beautiful, finite, physically satisfactory theory, quantum gravity, comma, in three dimensions, when there's nothing very interesting to happen. Okay. So then we have to go to four dimensions. But before going to, I think I will go to four dimensions next week. And tomorrow I should, maybe I should spend some time doing talking to you about the regular geometry.